When I was at school, I was very frustrated that I was seemed to always be asked to make choices. Shakespeare, or the second law of thermodynamics. Debussy, or DNA. Rubens, or relativity. Art, or science. And I found this demand to kind of compartmentalise us in one of these two groups deeply frustrating. At school, when I was about 12 or 13, I started getting really interested in mathematics as a fantastic language to sort of understand the world around us, in the sciences, the fact that we could somehow tell where we'd come from, where we were going to end up. The sciences and mathematics really excited me. But it was about the same time at school that I started learning the trumpet, and I played in a lot of orchestras, sang in choirs, did a lot of theatre. I appreciated art, even though I was rubbish at painting, but these two parts of my life have always been very important to me. Now, I turned out to be better at doing maths than I was at playing the trumpet, so I chose the mathematical route. But I've always been fascinated, even in my professional life, at seeing these connections between the two. I think it is something which, in a sense, links me to Bondi, because he was also somebody, you know, clearly a scientist, but also somebody who loved the arts. I mean, as a master of Churchill College, I think he loved the Barbara Hepworth statue that is in Churchill College. And I think if you look at Barbara Hepworth's work, it's a very sort of geometrical sort of art. So I've always been fascinated in this kind of divide, and it's something, of course, that C.P. Snow picked up in that lecture that he wrote and gave, the two cultures, that we do seem to compartmentalise our subjects. And actually, when I start to look at the two subjects that I love, I mean, mathematics and the arts, as my life has gone on, I realise that actually there's far more connection than there is difference between these two. There are certainly differences. But I think that there are these connections. And the connection is that we seem to be all obsessed with structure, and we seem to be interested in very similar sorts of structure. And so what I've done in this presentation is to take five of my favourite artists, mostly from the 20th century, and I want to explore with you why I think, in some sense, they are secret mathematicians, that they're doing things which are very similar to what I'm doing. I suppose the art which has most connection with mathematics, the one that people talk about most often, is the connection between art and between music and mathematics. You can often form an orchestra from the professors in a maths department, and I think that so my first sort of secret mathematician is the French composer Olivier Messiaen. Olivier Messiaen knew his maths. I mean, he very deliberately used mathematical structures in his composition to create certain effects, and he realised the power of the structures in mathematics to help him in his composition. And I think one of my favourite examples of this is one of my favourite pieces of music, the Quartet for the End of Time. The Quartet for the End of Time was a piece that he wrote while he was a prisoner of war during the Second World War. And in the prisoner of war camp, there was a rickety old piano. He played piano. And there was also three other prisoners, one a violinist, a clarinetist, and a cellist. So he decided to write a quartet for the four of them to perform in the camp. And in the first piece, the Liturgy de Cristal, he wanted to create this sense of never-ending time, and unease as well in this never-ending time. And to do this, what he did was to use some of my favourite numbers in the whole of mathematics, the prime numbers. So prime numbers, which are numbers which can't be divided by anything else, the indivisible numbers. And the prime numbers he chose are the prime 17 and 29. So when the piece opens, you hear, the other thing he was very obsessed with was bird themes. So he used to collect bird themes, and you hear the clarinet and the violin exchanging bird themes. But it's in the piano part where you hear the use of these prime numbers to create a sense of unease and a sense of timelessness. Because what Messiaen does is the following. He has a rhythm sequence, which you can see, this is the score of the opening movement. The rhythm sequence is a 17-note rhythm sequence, starting crotchet, 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 then quaver, and off it goes into this beautiful syncopated rhythm. Now, the rhythm sequence rigidly repeats itself every 17 notes. So you see, if you count 17 notes, you suddenly see crotchet, crotchet, crotchet again. So that goes up to here. That's where it starts repeating. The harmonic sequence is a 29-note harmonic sequence, which again rigidly repeats itself throughout the first movement, the same 29 chords, one after the other. And so that goes up to this place here, where you see the 29 chords starting again. Now, because he's chosen the primes 17 and 29, the fact that they're prime means that they don't interlock. It takes, you have to hear 17 times, 29 times, before the things interlock and it starts again. And by then, the movement's finished. So, although you'll never hear, you know, there's no way you'll be able to hear the sense of repetition of 29 chords. However, sort of here you feel it. And you sort of feel this sense of unease. You don't quite know what is what. But Messiaen is very deliberately using this piece of mathematics to create this sense of unease and never quite interlocking. So let's listen to the primes 17 and 29 in the first movement. And so the rhythm repeats now, crotchet, crotchet, crotchet. The harmonic sequence is still going through its 29 notes. And now the harmonic sequence starts again, but the rhythm is about two-thirds of the way through its thing, so it's something completely new to you. But here he's just repeating again and again, 17 notes rhythm, 29 notes harmony, to create this wonderful effect. And it's interesting that very often this interest that both the composers and artists have in certain structures and mathematicians have in structures, that very often you find those structures first of all in the natural world. And probably that's what we're all responding to in some ways, is why we find these structures interesting, is because they help us to navigate the natural world. So this use of primes and the way they can keep you out of sync is actually used in nature by a very curious little insect which lives in the forests in North America. This insect, a cicada, has a very, very curious life cycle. It hides underground for 17 years doing absolutely nothing. And then after 17 years, almost on the same day, these cicadas emerge from the forest and they party away. This is the sound of one cicada. You have to multiply this by about several million in the forest. The sound of the forest is so loud that residents move out. It's absolutely unbearable. And they party away, they eat the leaves, they mate, they lay eggs. And then after 6 weeks of partying, they all die. And the forest goes quiet again for another 17 years before the next brood appears from the eggs that were laid in the forest. So, terribly curious life cycle. First of all, how they manage to count to 17 is not quite clear. Biologists, because there's nothing in the natural cycle. I mean, you understand why things come around each year. I mean, that's still, how do you count 365 days? That's quite impressive. But of course, there's a rhythm to it. 17, well, at 11 you see sunspots, but that'd be pretty cool if they could count those. But 17, we don't know anything in the natural cycle, so how they do that is quite curious. But then again, 17, why did they choose 17? 17's a prime number, it's my favourite prime, it's the one I play for in my football team, but it's the one used by Messiaen. But why is it? You know, is it just a coincidence? Well, it seems not, because there's another species of cicada in North America that has a 13-year life cycle. And as you move over America, you find these different broods, 30, some 13s, some 17s, never 12, never 14, 15, 16, 18, just these two prime numbers, 13 and 17. And in fact, I got the chance to, these are one of my mathematical heroes, because they use my favourite numbers, and I got a chance this summer to go and see a 13-year brood appearing in the Nashville area when I was making this programme for the BBC during the summer. And it was extraordinary. It was completely quiet. We thought, oh my gosh, so are they going to appear? Then one day, everything just warmed up enough, and suddenly the trees were full of these things. And the residents, I remember talking to somebody at a cafe we went to, and he was quite a young guy. And he said, I remember these when I was a kid, and now we've had to wait another 13 years. In 1998 was when they were last heard. And 2024 is when they'll next appear in Nashville. So there must be something about these primes which is helping these cicadas. And it seems, we're not too sure, but the best hypothesis, it seems to have something to do very similar to the trick that Messiaen was using in that Liturgy de Cristal. Because we think that there might have been a predator, or maybe another species of cicada, that also used to appear periodically. And using the primes helped the the cicadas to keep out of sync. Those that had a non-prime number life cycle kept getting interlocked with the other predator. So, for example, suppose you have a predator which appears every 6 years in the forest. Now, a cicada that appears every 9 years in the forest is going to meet that predator just after two times of appearing. Year 18, divisible both by 6 and 9, they get wiped out. But if the cicada emerges every 7 years, then it can keep out of sync. 6 and 7 are then co-prime, so you have to wait until year 42 until they first meet each other. So a little bit like the cicada is a bit like the harmonic sequence, and the predator is a bit like the rhythm, and because of these prime numbers, they manage to keep out of sync. So it seems as if these primes are literally the key to the evolutionary survival of these cicadas, and they've been left with this 17 and 13 year life cycle. Sort of competition went on for who can find the biggest prime, and there's a stupid predators couldn't find it. The message here of maths, helps you in life, and help these cicadas to survive. So now it's intriguing. Messiaen was very deliberately sort of exploring mathematical structures. He understood these mathematical structures and applied them in his music. And I think very often when you talk about sort of art and science, it very often feels sort of a one-way traffic. It's the artist sort of plundering the science cabinet for interesting ideas. But that's not often, that's not always the case. Sometimes the artists are drawn to something for aesthetic reasons, interesting structure, and it turns out to have a mathematical significance afterwards. And there's an interesting case of this with rhythm in music. Here's a very famous sequence of numbers. What's the next number in this sequence? You're not allowed to play if you've read the Da Vinci Code, by the way. But 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, exactly. These are very famous sequence of numbers called the Fibonacci numbers, after the Italian mathematician who wrote about them from Pisa. And these are sort of somehow nature's favourite numbers. Fibonacci discovered them whilst sort of exploring growth in nature. So one place you find them very often is on the number of petals of flowers. If you take a flower, very often the number of petals on that flower is a number in this sequence. Sometimes you get double the number because you sort of have two copies of the flower. And if the number of petals isn't a number in the Fibonacci sequence, then that means a petal's fallen off your flower, which is how mathematicians get around exceptions. So, but actually, Fibonacci discovered them by the way. So these numbers are sort of have a growth built into them because you get the next number by adding the two previous ones together. And Fibonacci made them famous by looking at how rabbits multiply from one generation to the next. These are very idealized rabbits. You start with a pair of rabbits, which takes a month to mature. And then after that month, they can then have another pair of rabbits. They survive. The pair that they've just given birth to require a month to mature before they can have children. These are very idealized rabbits, which never die. So they go on forever. And they always have a pair that takes this month. So Fibonacci was interested in, with this rule, how do the numbers of rabbits, pairs of rabbits, grow from over the months, and he realized the key to this was this Fibonacci sequence, that the next generation will be the sum of the two previous generations. And that's why his discussion of these numbers in nature and growth is why we call them the Fibonacci numbers. But actually, they shouldn't be called the Fibonacci numbers at all, because they weren't discovered first by Fibonacci. They were in fact discovered about 100 years earlier by Indian poets and musicians who were exploring rhythm. And they were exploring what different sorts of rhythms can you get if you have a rhythm which has long and short beats. So, for example, if you've got four beats in the bar, then you could have four short beats. Or you could have two long beats. But in between there, you've got short, short, long, short, long, short, or long, short, short. So you've got five different rhythms that they could make out of these long and short beats. So they're interested, okay, what happens when you have five beats in the bar? How many different rhythms? And it started to get quite complicated. But what they spotted is there's a pattern here. How do we get the ones with five beats in the bar? We take the ones with four beats on the bar and add a short beat to those. And then we take the ones with three beats in the bar and add a long beat to those. And then we've got all the rhythms that were possible with five beats in the bar. So you get the next number of rhythms by adding the two previous numbers together. And so there's an account of this, these numbers appearing out of counting possible rhythms in poetry and in music. And you find this documented in a book by Hamachandra, for example, before Fibonacci discovered them. So here's the artist being interested in what's possible within their structures, discovering a sequence of numbers, which is very important to the mathematician and the scientist as well. So it's interesting, I've been talking very much about music being about rhythm, and you still sort of get that rhythm has something to do with number, and certainly Leibniz got it. I mean, he wrote that music is the pleasure the human mind experiences from counting without being aware that it is counting. But I think it goes a lot deeper than that, that actually the sort of structures that composers are drawn to in their harmonic work, in the actual overall composition of a piece, also reflect a lot with the mathematical structures, have a connection with the mathematical structures I'm interested in. And Igor Stravinsky, for example, wrote that the musician should find in mathematics a study as useful to him as the learning of another language is to a poet, that mathematics swims seductively just below the surface. And I suppose if you were going to think of a mathematician's favourite composer, most people would say, of course, it must be Bach. And Bach uses a lot of very deliberate mathematical tricks to do variations, symmetry tricks. And Bach's student, Mitzler, used to say that Bach's music was the process of sounding mathematics. And I think it's when you come to the 20th century where you see sort of composers really picking up this mantle from Bach and really exploring what other mathematical structures are out there that we can use to create interesting structures musically. And Stravinsky was, in his later compositions, a fan of Arnold Schoenberg's way of composing. People felt very boxed in by the sort of harmonic tradition. So they said, OK, well, let's throw away the harmonic tradition and consider all 12 notes of the chromatic scale as equal. And so, but when you throw something away, you need new structure in a way. It's, Stravinsky also used to write that he could only really be creative under constraints. He needed to be pushed in a new direction. And sometimes those constraints come very nicely from structures that are mathematical. So Schoenberg, for example, would explore, well, what if I do a permutation? What if I rearrange the 12 notes of the chromatic scale in some interesting order? And he would find something which had some interesting emotional or structural resonance. And then he would create, so this is a 12-tone row, and then he would create a sort of palette of 12-tone rows from which he would compose from. And that palette would be created by doing certain mathematical symmetrical operations on this 12-tone row. So what he would do is to do a translation. He would push each of the notes up by a semitone, and if they were came off the top octave, they would drop down again. So he would keep on pushing these things up by a semitone each time, and if they went over the top of the octave, they would come back down again. And he could create 12 different 12-tone rows from the original one, which all had a different sort of structural relationship to each other. He would then take all of these 12, do a reflection in the vertical line. Then he would do a reflection in the horizontal line. And then he would do a rotation of these things. And after doing this, he'd create a palette of 48 12-tone rows, which he would always be drawn to ones which, after doing that, had some interesting relationships between each other. But for me as a mathematician, you know, this is, I'm a group theorist, somebody who studies symmetry. This is the action of what I call the dihedral group of order 12 cross C2 on this structural object. But that's what, you know, Schoenberg's exploring exactly the same sort of thing that I do in my group theory. And interestingly, here I come back to my secret mathematician, Olivier Messiaen, because Messiaen was a great fan of this 12-tone row system. And here is an example where Messiaen, in the Quartet for the End of Time, he knew what he was doing with those prime numbers. But in this piece, the Il Default 2, it's a piece for solo piano, he's just chosen two 12-tone rows that for him are aesthetically really interesting because they somehow interlock in interesting ways. So he's been drawn to a choice of two 12-tone rows which he uses for this composition, purely for aesthetic reasons. Now, if you explore those two 12-tone rows as a sort of symmetrical permutations of the 12 notes, and you consider it mathematically, the structure that this thing generates is actually one of the most extraordinary symmetrical objects in my subject. It's a discovery of something called the sporadic group, the Matteo group of order 12. It was the beginning of a discovery of extraordinary weird symmetrical objects which don't exist in three-dimensional space. They exist in a higher dimensional space. Okay, these were discovered before Messiaen discovered them. He's not the first one to discover this structure. They were discovered at the end of the 19th century. But these are key, interesting symmetrical objects in my sort of subject. But here's Messiaen being drawn to them, actually generating them in a musical way, purely because he finds them interesting structurally and orally. So I can't show you this symmetrical object, because it lives in very high dimensional space if you want to represent it. But I can play it to you. So here is the Matteo group of order 12. Mathematics, it grows on you when you spend time. Another composer that I'm very keen on in the 20th century, who I almost chose as my secret mathematician, is Yannis Xenakis, who's a Greek composer, and he's extraordinary in his exploration of mathematics. And actually, this score here is a score for a piece called Metastasis, you can see it sort of looks like a piece of geometry. Rather, and I asked a cellist who once played this, how on earth you interpret this? And he says, you know, this is sort of a glissandi that you're meant to do, and you've got each of the cellos doing different things, and you've sort of create this sort of geometric structure in sounds. But he also was interested in symmetry, and I'm going to play you a solo cello piece called Nomus Alpha, which actually he dedicated to Évariste Galois, who was the discoverer of the language of group theory, and Felix Klein. And this cello piece uses a symmetrical object to do variations. Now, it's a symmetrical object you all know. So I want you to listen to this piece and see what symmetrical object is conjured up in your mind's eye by the following. Was in fact a cube, but even I'm quite hard pushed to hear a cube hiding inside there. But actually, it's a, what did you?
I would have said a
triangle. A triangle, interesting. Okay, it's a little bit unfair because I haven't given you enough of the piece actually to hear the cube starting to play in a way. But what Xenakis did is the. The cello has various things that it can do, like the pizzicati and the glissandi, and he encoded these on the corners of the cube. And then in each different variation, he would do a symmetry of the cube, and he would then read off the instructions for the cello from the points on the cube. It would start with glissandi, pizzicato, and he had another cube which was doing a similar sort of symmetry, which would keep track of the sort of rhythms and the amount of time spent. And so these cubes, the constraints of the symmetry of the cube, would constrain the sort of things that he would vary in each piece. So the cube is sort of hiding underneath there. Now, it's interesting that Xenakis was a very multi-talented guy. I mean, as well as being interested in maths and music as well. I mean, if you think about it, this score looks, as I said, very geometric. He was also an architect. And here there's a building that there's plans for a building he built, which looked rather similar to the score for Metastasis. And he was an architect, and he worked on this building with my second choice of secret mathematician, which is Le Corbusier. Because I think architecture, again, may be one of the obvious choices of an art which definitely has to know its maths. I mean, these buildings won't stand up unless you do the maths. So I guess it's kind of one where maths can be limiting, but in the modern age, maths has been very liberating. I mean, if you look at the architects that are creating the extraordinary structures around the world now, I mean, Zaha Hadid, for example, I live quite near the Olympic Stadium, you see this extraordinary shape that she's created. By understanding the mathematics now, they're exploiting the sort of palette of shapes that we have to make the sort of the landscapes, the urban landscapes of the 21st century. Le Corbusier was somebody who loved mathematics and also particularly loved the idea of these Fibonacci sequences. And he had these two sort of sequences of numbers, series rouge and series bleu, that he would use to create the ratios inside the buildings that he created. He felt that these numbers were associated very naturally with growth, with proportions in the body. He had this thing called modular man. So very sort of ancient idea that a building should reflect the body, going back to Vitruvius. And so he sort of explored the way that these Fibonacci-like sequences. So you can see after a while they settle down into the same rule. You add the two previous numbers. So you add 0.43 and 0.70 to get 1.13. So it's the same sort of idea hiding behind these numbers and a careful choice to sort of start things off. And these numbers, you can see a very natural sort of way that they can be built into a beautiful piece of geometry. Because if you take, say, if you build a building with a room with 1x1 proportions, then add, you sort of can fit onto that another 1x1 room. But now you've got a 1x2 block, so add a 2x2 room onto that. Now you've got a dimension 3, so add a 3x3 room, 5x5, 8x8. And as you do this, you build up a sequence of rooms which you can put a very beautiful, what's called the Fibonacci, or an example of a logarithmic spiral through this structure. So the ratio of this rectangle that is beginning to emerge out of this is actually tending towards this very special number, the golden ratio, which is a ratio that you find a lot in nature, but also very deliberately and sometimes unintentionally built into a lot of structures. So, for example, if you take the Parthenon, the Greeks knew about this the properties of this golden ratio, that it was has very nice sort of kind of interrelation in this rectangle, that you find it sort of embedded in structures like the Parthenon. And actually, a lot of composers as well find the golden ratio very appealing. You find Debussy, for example, using it very deliberately in pieces that he wrote. And for Le Corbusier as well, La Cité Radieuse, which I think is in Marseille, which is where I should be tonight because Arsenal are playing Marseille tonight, but I prefer to come and talk to you, it is actually uses a lot of these the series rouge and the series bleu to create patterns of rooms which have this interesting sort of growth in them, which are a bit like the Fibonacci growth. Again, I was saying, not many people find this building appealing, actually, but and I think it is an interesting one when you're inside. But of course, this idea of buildings reflecting important ratios is not a new one. In fact, if you go back to Palladio, Palladio is probably, if Bach's your favourite composer, I think for a mathematician, if I was going to choose one across all of the centuries, Palladio is just, there's something beautiful about Palladio buildings when you go inside them. You just feel there's something just perfect about them. And the reason is that Palladio is tapping into this idea, which really goes back to Vitruvius, that that buildings should have, the rooms in the buildings should have these beautiful whole number ratios, 1 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3. And the reason this, we find this just, if you go into one which is slightly off, you can sort of feel it. But when you go into a Palladio villa, there is just a kind of something special about it. And it is, in a way, because it's reflecting these musical harmonies. If I put strings on the sides of the rooms, of the different lengths of the rooms, and pluck them, then the notes that they make are actually the notes that we find harmonic. I mean, the whole number ratios are the key to the musical harmony that we have chosen. The 1 to 2 relationship is the octave, the 2 to 3 relationship is the perfect fifth. And Palladio is tapping into this, that when you go into a Palladio room, it's sort of frozen music, because you're feeling the same thing when you're in a room with those sort of perfect proportions. And it's interesting, you can find plans written by Le Corbusier and by Palladio, where both are sort of exploring the different ways you can fit the rooms with their different ratios together. Interestingly, sort of Palladio is obsessed with symmetry, whilst Le Corbusier, sort of very 20th century, is trying to disrupt that symmetry. And certainly you see that when you come to look at the sort of two villas, a Palladio villa, perfect symmetry, the Le Corbusier one, using these ratios from the Fibonacci, but also enjoying sort of disrupting the symmetry. And you can almost see it in the Modular Man. Modular Man is drawn in an asymmetrical way, whilst, of course, Palladio is tapping into Vitruvius's ideas. Vitruvian Man is a solution to an architecture problem by Da Vinci, Leonardo da Vinci. And you see this sort of perfect symmetry. And I suppose, actually, Leonardo da Vinci is a great example of somebody who sort of united all of these ideas of art and science. And, of course, a fantastic visual artist. And so my third secret mathematician comes from the world of visual arts. But rather than choosing Leonardo da Vinci, I've gone for a 20th century one again, who is Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali he loved scientific ideas and as a sort of inspiration for the sort of pictures that he was exploring. And in fact, he once wrote, I am a carnivorous fish swimming in two waters, the cold water of art and the hot water of science. And when he would invite people round to his house for sort of meetings and things, he would always love bringing in scientists because he felt they were the ones with the exciting new ideas, the exciting structures. And so you see in his art, there's a lot of, all across the different sciences, of course, ideas of relativity and time and space being explored. DNA was something that he loved sort of threading through the double helix into his art. But mathematics as well, and so especially sort of very classical sort of geometric objects. If you take the Sacrament of the Last Supper, for example, he frames it inside this dodecahedron made out of 12 pentagons. Again, the dodecahedron hides inside it the golden ratio again, the sort of special proportions. It was also, Dali was, it was interesting because he was a highly religious man, but he also used to combine the sort of religious and the scientific in his art. And so Plato, for example, associated the dodecahedron with the shape of the universe. So I think that's also what he's doing, is playing into that idea of the dodecahedron being fundamental shape for the universe. And it's interesting, I think here again you see a curious example of how the artists helped the scientists. Because these shapes, the Platonic solids, we all knew about, but there were 13 other interesting shapes discovered by Archimedes, which were made up not of just of the same shape, not like a dice, but more like a football, of pentagons and hexagons together. And actually, although there was an account of the discovery of 13, we sort of didn't really know what they were. And it took to the Renaissance and the artists who were exploring the idea of perspective, the ability to create three dimensions, for these kind of shapes to reappear and for us to sort of reclaim them as the 13 interesting additions to the Platonic solids. And for an artist, this was a great exercise in showing off how good you were at perspective, if you could create one of these three-dimensional objects on a two-dimensional canvas. So, for example, this painting here from 1495, well, you see the little dodecahedron on the desk, but up in the top left-hand corner, this sort of glass floating object, which is a rhombicuboctahedron, made up of triangles and squares. And this is one of the 13 Archimedean solids that the artists of that period, including Leonardo da Vinci, sort of helped us to recover, because we could see them very tangibly for the first time in books and transmit them. But Dali wasn't just interested in these very classical shapes. Of course, I suppose the shape of the 20th century is the fractal. And the fractal is, again, comes back to nature. It's sort of a shape you see a lot in nature. And it's you create fractals by this kind of infinite iterative process. So if I take a triangle, cut a smaller triangle out of that, cut a smaller triangle out of the smaller triangles and go off to infinity, you create this shape which is called the Sierpinski gasket. But here you can see Dali in the Visage of War actually creating his own version of the Sapinsky gasket. The three sockets in the skull, the eyes, two eyes in the mouth, are then, you see, another skull inside those, and then another skull inside each of those holes. So actually, in an infinite regress, he's actually creating an artistic version of this this fractal. I mean, another artist who actually sort of... here again, you see Dali, he knows about this stuff. But if you take something like Jackson Pollock, he didn't know about fractals, but what he was actually doing was creating fractal structures. We kind of laugh that Jackson Pollock's painting sold for some extraordinary sum. It beat the record a few years ago. And a lot of people will say, well, you know, my 13-year-old daughter can make that. You know, you just flip the paint around. And, you know, what's so special about these paintings? But you feel there is something special. It's quite hard to reproduce this. And the reason is that if you analyse these mathematically, what Jackson Pollock is doing is creating a fractal structure. If you magnify a portion of a Jackson Pollock and blow it up, and you do it again and blow it up, and you do it again and blow it up, if you put the four next to each other, it's quite hard to put them in order. The structure stays stays at the same complexity as you zoom in on the picture. Of course, at some point you're going to hit something where some simplicity appears, but not that you can see visually even when you're close up. So Jackson Pollock was actually drawn to, and you can actually measure the dimension of these things, and it's sort of dimension as actually between 1 and 2. We think of a line as one-dimensional and a canvas as two-dimensional. What you create here is actually something which, if you measure mathematically, has a dimension between 1 and 2. And actually Jackson Pollock was drawn to was fractals with a dimension which is very close to the ones we see in nature. Which again is why we seem to be drawn to the ones that we love of Jackson Pollock. Some are a bit too extreme, some a bit too simple. Now, interesting, we went to Jackson Pollock's studio when I was making this program for the BBC during the summer, and we met one of the scientists who analysed these. And this technique has been used to actually reveal fakes, because you can somebody tries to splatter, says, "Here's a Jackson Pollock in my in a garage." And, but you can actually analyse this and say, well, it's not got any fractal structure, so you can throw it out as a fake. But actually, you can use this this knowledge to create fakes. And here is my fake Jackson Pollock that we made. I'm hoping to sell this on eBay and cash in. But the interesting thing is, the reason that... the way we did this was to have a pendulum with some paint on it, but it's not a simple pendulum. Pendulum creates something very sort of regular, is why we use it for the time. But if you have a kicked pendulum, a sort of chaotic pendulum, then the actual motion it produces a fractal. Fractals are kind of the shape of chaos. So we rigged this up and did this thing, and it's not quite Jackson Pollock, but it was pretty convincing, I think. The curious thing is, it actually taps into the way Jackson Pollock created his paintings, because he had very bad balance. He was kind of a very sort of unstable guy, and he used to drink a lot. So when he was painting, what he would do is he'd be a chaotic pendulum, not quite knowing where. And that seems to be key. It's quite hard to copy. Salvador Dali is not only interested in these fractals, but also is interested in shapes which went beyond our three-dimensional world. And he was interested in, for example, four-dimensional geometry. Now, if you think of a three-dimensional cube, I can unwrap into two dimensions and make what we call a net. If you want to make a cube, you cut a sort of cross shape and you fold it up and you've got six faces and it makes a cube. Well, you can do the same thing from three dimensions into four dimensions. So a four-dimensional cube, mathematical thing which only exists in my mind, I can actually unwrap and then show you. And Dali was kind of fascinated by this idea of something that you can't see being unwrapped into our visual world. And so, and I think for him, it really tapped into that kind of idea of his sort of spiritual side, that the spirit is something beyond our three-dimensional world. He uses it in this piece, The Crucifixion, the four-dimensional cube, which is made up out of, when it's unwrapped into its net, is four three-dimensional cubes stacked on each other and four cubes around the outside. So if you wanted to you join the top and the bottom, the two sides, but then you run out of dimensions to be able to do the next wrap. But here is kind of Dali's idea that you need to wrap this up to transcend the physical world. Now, my fourth secret mathematician comes from the world of literature, and I think from literature is probably a harder thing to somehow match up to mathematical structures. But it's probably top of the list of most mathematicians' favourite writers is Luis Jorge Borges, who's an Argentinian writer, and he just was fascinated at exploring mathematical ideas in his short stories, ideas of paradox, of infinity, of geometry as well. And one of my favourite of his is a book called a short story called The Library of Babel. Beautiful story, 10 pages long. You can read it quickly, but every time I reread this story, I find new things in it. And in this story, the librarian, who's at the sort of heart of the narrator in the story, is stuck inside this library. And he's trying to, in the story, he's sort of trying to understand the nature of this library. And he starts off by describing it. The universe, which others call the library, is composed of an indefinite and perhaps infinite number of hexagonal galleries. From any one of the hexagons, one can see internally the upper and lower floors. Well, here is Borges exploring through this librarian a question which has been obsessing us for centuries, and especially the 20th century and 21st century. Well, what is the shape of our universe? What is it? You know, is it infinite, or does it have some sort of boundary, or is it fine? You know, this at the heart of this story is a question that science has been obsessed with. And it's interesting, as the librarian goes on, he starts to explore the library and try and find sort of structure in it that can help him to understand from his local environment what his global world looks like. So, for example, he takes the books and he discovers that there's a pattern in the books. Each book is of 410 pages, each page of 40 lines, each line of some 80 letters. The orthographical symbols are 25 in number. And he begins to get the feel that every book that is possible is in this library, and only one copy. So if one starts to think about it, you can actually count the number of books that are possible in this library. If you think that any book has 25 letters that it could have as its first letter, the next letter, we've got another 25 choices of letter. So the books, there are 25 times 25 choices for the first two letters of the book. So if we carry this on, so we've got 80 letters in a line, 40 lines, 410 pages. So if you calculate up, the number of possible books in that library is 25 to the power 80 times 40 times 410. That is a lot of books. If every atom in this universe was a book in our observable universe, you wouldn't get anywhere near this number. There's only 10 to the power 80 atoms in the observable universe. So there's a huge number of books. However, there are still just a finite number of books. If there's one and one only copy of each book, the library must be finite. So you begin to think, well, what does this mean? Does this mean the library has some boundary and I could get outside it? But if this is all there is, you know, I think the ancient Greeks used to have that conception of our universe as being inside some glass ball that's the shape of a dodecahedron. But, you know, that doesn't make sense to us now. We don't seem to be living in the Truman Show. You're not going to suddenly get to the edge of the set and find that there's a film crew outside filming everything inside. I mean, well, maybe some people think that's what the universe is like. But so how do you make sense of this? How do you make sense if the universe is finite, but it probably doesn't have an outside, because what's outside that? You've got to solve that. And by the end of the book, the librarian has come to some sort of conclusion. I venture to suggest this solution to the ancient problem. The library is unlimited and cyclical. If an eternal traveller were to cross it in any direction, after centuries he would see the same volumes were repeated in the same disorder. And what's intriguing is this taps into really one of the ways that we're thinking that our universe might be constructed. That our universe might well not be, might well be finite. It may not have, it certainly doesn't, if it's finite, it's not got a wall out which we're going to hit. But then how do you solve that? Well, maybe it's cyclical. If I look out into space and I keep on walking, maybe I'll just come back to the beginning again. And there's a beautiful example of this. I don't know whether any of you played the game of Asteroids, wasted your childhoods playing this game. But it's a lovely game where the screen is your universe. It's finite. There it is. But this universe is interestingly joined up, because if I go off the bottom of the screen, I reappear at the top. And if I go off one side, I reappear at the other side. So as far as somebody stuck inside this universe is concerned, it hasn't got a wall. I never bounce off a wall. I just keep on going, cyclically. Well, what's interesting is that if I indulge myself and put this two-dimensional universe in three dimensions, I can actually see what shape this universe is. Because as we see, the spaceship, when it goes off to the one side, comes in the other, off the top, that comes in the bottom. Well, actually, this shape means that the top and the bottom of this universe is joined up. We might as well join it up. We've got three dimensions. So it's actually a cylinder. But the two ends are joined up as well. So let's join those up. If we go off one end of the one side of the screen, we go into the other. So actually the shape of this universe, if I allow myself to embed it in three dimensions, is the shape of a bagel, or what we in mathematics call a torus. So one solution to the shape of Borges's library is that maybe, if you think of this lecture room here, suppose this is our universe. And so if I go out to the right-hand side or your left-hand side, I reappear at the right-hand side here. So I've joined up these two sides. And then the top and the bottom of the lecture theatre might be joined up. So I go off the top, I come in at the bottom. That's the game of asteroids, but we've got another direction we could go in. What if I went out the back of the theatre? I could reappear through where you just all came in. And now I've created a box, a three-dimensional box, which is our universe. There's nothing outside of it, because if you go outside, you come back in just the other wall. And now this universe is finite, but has no boundary, but is somehow cyclical. And so this is what the universe would look like. If a light beam travels from the back of my head and goes out there, then it reappears at the back of the theatre. So I can see myself, a copy of myself, again and again and again. So the universe looks like just lots of copies of our lecture theatre. And maybe some of the stars out there are just repeats of ours, which have come round and cyclically hit us. So that's, you know, the mathematicians have been exploring. This is what we would call a four-dimensional torus. It's if you join this thing up, you'll get a shape which is the same as that two-dimensional universe wrapped up. And in some ways, this is one of the biggest questions in mathematics, which was recently answered. What are the possible ways we could wrap up our universe such that it is finite but doesn't have a boundary? And this is something called the Poincaré conjecture, which was solved by Grigori Perelman. In fact, I've been exploring this kind of idea of the nature, shape, and Borges's story in a piece of theatre that I've been doing. I've started with the composer, and I'm also working with Complicité on this. In this piece of theatre, I ended up actually doing a dance of some mathematics. This is the proof of the irrationality of the square root of 3 in dance. Which must be a first for mathematics and dance, I think. But I'm not going to suggest you the whole proof. So but it's in fact doing this piece that I learned about my fifth secret mathematician, who comes from the world of choreography. The choreographer told me about Rudolf Laban, who used to view what a piece of choreography really as a sort of geometry in motion, and was very responsible for creating a sort of language to try and sort of record what happens in a dance piece in a very mathematical way. And he used to want his dancers to actually conceive of the space around them almost as a Platonic solid. So he would get his dancers to imagine a dodecahedron or an icosahedron, and that would be where their body should move. We tend to get limited rather like Vitruvian man in two dimensions. But Rudolf Laban wanted to think of dancers as a kind of three-dimensional Vitruvian man or woman. So he wrote, "Man is inclined to follow the connecting lines of the 12 corner points of an icosahedron, with his movements travelling, as it were, along an invisible network of paths." Now, I talked a lot about art being interested in mathematical structures, but I'd like to end just with a small episode of mathematics being viewed really as an interest in artistic structures. Because I would say that the mathematician is very often very creative person, but the choices that they make are very often choices which are motivated by words like beauty, simplicity, logic, structure. And one of the mathematicians who inspired me as a kid to become a mathematician, my teacher recommended that I read G.H. Hardy's A Mathematician's Apology. And in that book, he writes, "A mathematician, like a painter or a poet, is a maker of patterns. I'm interested in mathematics only as a creative art." And mathematics is a little bit like that Library of Babel. There are infinitely many theorems that I can write down. I can get a computer to churn out mathematics. But the art of the mathematician is picking out which of those books in the Library of Babel has something worth talking about, something which moves the soul, something which has surprises, has drama in it. And our choices of the mathematics that I choose to stand up and talk about in my seminars is motivated by many of the same things which motivate the artist. And it is about choosing things, choosing which of those theorems. The computer can churn it out, but we have to select amongst all of these information choices. Why are we talking about this piece of mathematics as opposed to any other? I mean, for example, I love this little theorem of Fermat's. It's the fact that if you take a prime number and you divide it by 4 and it has remained a 1, Fermat proved that you'll always be able to write that prime number as a sum of 2 squares. So, for example, 41 divided by 4, you'll get a remainder 1. I can write 41 as 25, 5 squared plus 16, 4 squared. Well, that's amazing. And there are infinitely many primes like this, and Fermat was able to prove that they will always, these primes have something to do with squares. Well, that's kind of amazing. It's totally useless, but really amazing. But that's the point. You know, I'm not interested in that final result. I'm interested in the way the journey goes. You start with a prime, which is divisible, or has remained a 1 on divisibility by 4. It's like sort of an opening theme in a piece of music. And then, but gradually, Fermat twists and turns it and changes it, and then you get this moment of surprise where this reveal, it's actually squares. 2 squares suddenly appear. Where did they come from? They're a different theme. And you see this proof interweaving. There are many different proofs of this, and they all have their own different magic about them. But it's the journey, it's the drama, it's the surprise, which is why we loved this theorem and we like talking about it. And I think in my choice of mathematics, I don't expect you to understand any of this, but this is the mathematics that I do. I like exploring the world of symmetry, discovering new symmetrical objects in high dimensions. So, but I'm choosing, a bit like Messiaen, I want to choose things that have some interesting surprise in them. And this symmetrical structure that I discovered connects the world of symmetry to the world of number theory and elliptic curves, two different areas which don't seem to be connected at all. And that's why I love talking about this in seminars, because there's this moment when you say, look at this, something new is appearing out of this. It's absolutely magic. And it has drama in it and that moment of surprise. And that, I think, why the mathematician is very sympathetic to the artist, because what motivates us in the sort of mathematics we like to add to the canon and talk about is very often motivated by a similar love of structure and aesthetics. Let me end with a quote. This is a quote by a mathematician or an artist. To create consists precisely in not making useless combinations. Invention is discernment, choice. The sterile combinations do not even present themselves to the mind of the inventor. Now, how many people think that's an artist talking about his or her work? One vote over there, a few votes here. How many people think it's a mathematician talking about their work? Well, I've obviously done very well in my talk. How many people are not sure? It could be either. Frankly, I'm going to, which is fair enough. I mean, well, it is in fact a mathematician. It's Henri Poincaré talking about the act of creativity in mathematics. And maybe the word invention gave it away, because an artist doesn't often talk about invention. However, Stravinsky always used to talk about his work as invention and discovery. And I was at a conference last week with Michael Nyman, and I asked him, you know, whether do you feel you discover things or create things? And something which is often talked about in my subject. And he told me a story about really how he discovered an interesting new musical structure, which he then discovered the Scissor Sisters had stolen, and he took them to court. But he was able to prove that, in fact, it was his. The litigation went through, and it had never been seen before. He'd made this discovery, which was part of his music. But for me, I think that we do tend to compartmentalise our education so much that we have to make these choices. And I hope I've shown you that really we need to knock down these boundaries in our education and also just in our general lives, because in some sense what we're all doing is we're all interested in the structures that bubble beneath both art, science and nature. Thank you.